from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The American College campus is a beautiful place come fall semester. Trees, quads, lecture halls, frisbees, the chatter of students. But beneath all that, there's a big rumble right now. Disruptive change is coming. 4 years of Socrates and keg parties can break the bank for a lot of American families these days. Student debt is towering. And here comes the internet asking, why do you need an old-fashioned campus, a traditional American college education? This hour on Point, higher education may be at the breaking point and the internet revolution. You can join the conversation. Do you see a higher ed bubble? Is it going to blow? Can internet education really fill the void? How's it going to work with or without the campus? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is Jeff Salingo, editor-at-large for the Chronicle of Higher Education, author of the forthcoming book, College Unbound, The Future of Higher Education and What It Means for Students. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be here, Tom.
Everybody's talking about online education all of a sudden. Everybody's, complaining to the heavens about what college costs and student debt. Are these things on a collision course? Is the old headed out, or do we know?
Well, we don't quite know, but it's definitely headed in that direction. I think that a lot of traditional colleges are kind of coming upon a fiscal cliff here. A lot of that is a result of the economy since 2008, and increases and improvements in online education since then. So you have kind of on one hand the traditional hitting kind of this fiscal cliff, and on the other side you have improved technology and improved alternatives on the other side.
MOOC is what I'm reading about all over the place. This acronym MOOC, Massive Open Online Courses. What's going on?
Well, they actually got their start a couple of years ago in Canada, where a couple of professors basically opened up their online course to anybody across the world, and they got a couple of thousand people to join it. But the most famous one was done by two Stanford professors last year, where they attracted 160,000 students from 190 countries. Now, only about 23,000 students actually finished the course 10 weeks later. But what they received, this was a free course, by the way, they received a certificate of accomplishment. And the top 1,000 students were emailed by the professors asking for their resume, and those resumes were passed on to Silicon Valley companies. This was a course in artificial intelligence. And I actually talked to a couple of those students, one of whom actually ended up getting a job at Google, and he thinks largely because of that course he took from Stanford for free.
But now it's for free, but we see all these big-name universities getting into this, Harvard, MIT, Stanford, we'll talk to in just a minute, and others. What are they doing? What are they offering, and what's their vision?
Unclear what their vision is right now. I think that most of these large universities with brand names and a lot of money, meaning big endowments, are throwing a lot of things against the wall and seeing what works. And I think that's kind of interesting. Whether what they're doing right now will be the reality in a couple of years is unclear, but they are definitely getting people's attention, both the public, the lawmakers, the foundations, the students, and of course, competing colleges.
Are they looking to steal the bacon from smaller, less globally famous colleges and universities, or to supplement them, to work with them, roll over them?
Perhaps all of the above. It's unclear what their exact business model is, but I think you can see a couple of pieces of it already coming out. For example, these are free classes, so if you actually want the credential, you might go and sit for an exam somewhere and pay for that and pay for the credential that comes from that. Employers might pay for students who come through these courses, very much like the person I just described who ended up going to Google. Google would pay $25,000 to find students like that. And finally, I think these potentially could be an alternative admission system for some of these very elite universities, which end up rejecting 90% of the students who apply. Just imagine that if you find students who can take your courses anywhere around the world and they do well, that could be potentially a different door in to these universities.
And a big market for these universities. Of course, we have commercial higher ed that's taken off all over the place, sometimes controversially, but really taken off. You're talking here about a credential in taking a course or some courses from a brand name university. What about a degree? What about the whole experience? Are people imagining that will migrate online and away from that brick and mortar that you say is headed for a cliff?
I doubt it, especially at it definitely will not happen at these elite universities. I mean, the Harvards of the world are going to be here, in my opinion, in 100 years. And most colleges will still be here at least in 50 years. But a number of colleges are in real trouble. The colleges that most people have never heard of that struggle every year to attract students and attract money. I think those are the ones that are in real trouble because there's not really anything that differentiates them from the school down the street. And so why would somebody want to pay, if they're a private institution, you know, $50,000 to go to one of these institutions? And so right now, you know, we kind of have what I would describe as the buffet. You know, it's one size fits all higher education. And I think that these MOOCs and other alternatives that are coming out now provide kind of an a la carte menu for students. And so perhaps in the future, you can take a couple of these classes, you can take classes somewhere else, and you bundle them all up together and you get a credential from somewhere. But it won't be necessarily that little college you never heard of down the street.
Boy, that is the sound of disruption and also a certain lack of clarity about how exactly this is going to be understood, exercised, used. Jeff Salingo with the Chronicle of Higher Education. Please stand by there in Washington. I want to go to California right now. And John Mitchell, he's just been appointed as Stanford University's first ever vice provost for online learning. He's a professor of computer science at Stanford. John Mitchell, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
What are you going to be offering that you have not to date, sir?
Well, we're going to try a lot of different things in line with some of Jeff's comments. We will continue to have a number of free online courses, and those will cover a number of different topics. So we'll let students all over the world sign in and try our courses and learn from our faculty. Another very exciting thing about the technology, and Jeff mentioned how this has improved a lot over recent years, is to try new things on campus, to try to improve education for our own students, try to get in some cases, people out of the lecture hall and in front of video screen to cover material that's been on lecture. But that frees up time for students and faculty to meet informally, to meet in smaller groups, to have the kind of discussion that people really want to go off to college and have. So I think there are many different possibilities here, both for on-campus and off-campus students. And I think we'll see a lot of enthusiasm surrounding that will improve education, not just at the end of this process, if it ever ends, but also as we go along.
How do you justify handing out free online courses to anybody anywhere in the world when you've got your paying customers, your Stanford students, they're paying, I don't know what these days, all in, 50, 60K more a year to come to Stanford? How do you justify that?
Well, it's really part of an experiment to see how we can reach people. As part of developing these online courses, we're developing new ways to provide feedback to students in an automated way that takes time, frees up time for faculty to do other things. It's also a great way for our faculty to get their view of their field out. And I think the faculty who've been involved have found this very exciting, invigorating, and it's helped them reach a much broader audience, which brings attention back to us and is really helpful in getting comments and input from people around the world about the subjects that our faculty
sure.
are researching and teaching.
There's an education model here that's evolving. We'll look at that, but there also has to be a business model. That's what keeps big, great universities like yours operating century after century. What's the business model if you're giving it away wholesale globally?
Well, the market will work itself out in a certain way, and we'll see how that goes over the next two or three years. There are many ways that these online courses could provide some form of revenue. I don't think we're really looking to make a profit in any sense there. There might be some ways that some income could come, at least at the level that would offset the costs of producing those kind of courses.
Are you looking to steal students from, you know, somewhere out in America or around the world that otherwise might be attending a brick-and-mortar four-year college, and now instead they're online, they've got the Stanford imprint on the course they're taking? Are they going to come to you instead of that local college? Would that local regional college go away, John?
Oh, I don't think that's really likely to happen at a large scale anytime soon. I think many colleges of all sizes, community colleges, smaller colleges, state universities, there's a wide spectrum here. And in many of those places, there are enthusiastic, knowledgeable, skilled teachers. And there are many ways for them to participate and interact with students using new technology and possibly using material from other places. So I think we'll see some change in the way education is delivered. But there'll be a role for many different kinds of institutions in the future.
Hey, Jeff, you know, when it came to banking, this new era meant a lot of smaller banks went away. When it came to media, we've seen a lot of local newspapers, regional newspapers really struggle. Will universities really be different, Jeff, or won't this bring some of that same dynamic where the big, successful online operations roll over smaller ones?
Well, I think there are a lot of similarities to the newspaper industry. I've talked a lot about this in the last couple of years. The newspaper industry, the music industry, the book publishing industry, and really these the debate over these open courses, I think, in higher education really mirrors the one the newspaper industry encountered in the late 90s when most publications began giving away their content for free online but continue to charge for the print product. I think the big difference here is that higher education is a heavily subsidized, heavily regulated industry. You know, me and you can't, we can start a newspaper or start an online newspaper pretty easily. We can't start a university pretty easily, especially one that we hope would get federal financial aid because we need to get accredited, et cetera. So I think while there are some similarities between the disruptions that happened in these other industries, I think the one big difference is that this is heavily regulated.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about our high-cost, maybe unsustainable college system, American higher education, at the breaking point for many families, now facing an internet revolution. With John Mitchell of Stanford University, he's just been appointed the first-ever vice provost for online learning there. Jeff Salingo is with us from the Chronicle of Higher Education. Everybody's talking about MOOCs, massive open online courses, and what that might mean for traditional university. John, Jeff, I've got a response online here. Inez says, something's got to change. We can't have young people starting out in life $100,000 in debt for 4 years of school. I mean, we hope that's not too many, but we know it happens. James says, it is somewhat amazing that there are not inexpensive, high-quality educational resources for all Americans. Maybe Bill Gates could show us the way with a Gates University or something. John Mitchell, do you think that online education is going to knock down the cost of higher education for Americans? It has become a huge issue, as you well know.
Well, I think that technology offers ways to deliver courses to a large number of people at less cost. So that's certainly going to affect the market. I think there certainly is a market. An interest in learning, that's the best thing here, is that people are excited about learning things online and in various ways. That will change their lives. And I think the fact that we can deliver to and interact with a large number of people at lower cost will certainly reduce costs in many ways.
If you can change the market, if you can knock down the cost, then what happens to the revenue structure that supports, you know, quads and trees and flower beds and lecture halls? Do those Some of those have to go away, John.
Well, it remains to be seen. We'll see how this all works itself out. But I hope that people will appreciate the value of colleges and universities. And I think that one thing you can see about this revolution is it really is from within the college and university system. So you have many smart, hardworking people at colleges and universities across the country and around the world trying to figure out exactly the problem you mentioned. How can we teach more people effectively? How can we lead, interact with students in a way that's great for us and great for them? And how can we do it in a sustainable, affordable way?
A lot of American families are happy to see that question being asked. I can imagine some skepticism about whether it can all go on as it has. You're not exactly saying that. Let's hear from our listeners. Augusta, Georgia. Heather, thanks for calling. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm at Augusta State University, and I'm a associate professor of history, and we're doing all the same things that you all are talking about right now. We're in the point of consolidation with our major medical college here, and we will be a new university in January, and we're talking about what to do about class size and class space. And so hybrid and online offerings have really been pushed this year, and this summer was the first test of that. We offered in our history department online and traditional classes, and our online classes were the ones to fill. So that was a revelation for us that we needed to think outside of the box with courses like history, and how do you teach history online in a way that still has the same types of things that we need in a traditional classroom.
Heather, help me understand this. You're saying your online offerings were the ones that really had the big demand, but is that from your students who are at Augusta State? They're on the campus, but they want to take the course online?
They want to take the course online. Some of them also were coming from Fort Gordon, our military base.
Right.
Some of them were non-traditional students, but a lot of them were our regular students who in the summertime wanted to have summer jobs, and that was a way for them to be able to take their classes.
What about when it's not summertime, when they come back for fall? Are they still at the campus but taking courses online, Heather?
In other departments they have, and we've only offered them in our upper-level classes for juniors and seniors, but now with what happened in the summertime, we're thinking we need to do this as a regular, at least hybrid, if not totally online courses going on through the future to see what happens.
Hybrid meaning you'll move more of the teaching and learning online and less, I guess, in a physical classroom. What do you think that means long-term for your college, Heather?
I think that it means that we will get more students who might have gone to another college or another online college, for instance. It also means that it frees up the physical time that I need to be on campus as a faculty member, that I can be doing research abroad or other places where I need to be as a Latin American historian, but yet still be teaching my class with the same effectiveness.
That sounds pretty cool. Do you think colleges and universities will still be around as we've known them physically, or will that diminish because you just won't have the same need for all that overhead?
To me, I think we need to have both. I don't think that we need to expand our dormitories and expand in the way that, you know, we would have years ago, but I think the actual physical presence of the campus is still necessary to say we are part of a college and the students need that sort of face-to-face contact, even if it doesn't happen as often. I get more students now who talk with me in virtual office hours on Facebook than they do in my actual office.
Boy, things are really changing. Heather at Augusta State, thank you so much for your call. Jeff Salingo, hybrid courses, how popular is this? What does it tend to mean?
This is actually where I think the future of the bricks and mortar campus might be going. And basically, a hybrid course is half and half, right? So instead of taking your entire course online or your entire course in person, you take part of it in person, and you basically do what is called the high impact or high touch stuff in person, and then the rest of it is done online. And this has become very popular, for example, at the University of Central Florida, which is one of the largest public universities in the country. I think they have more than 50, 60,000 students down there. You know, 60% of the students there take either an online or blended course each year. And these are students who are residential students, you know, living on campus, and they're taking a part of their courses in a blended environment or a hybrid environment.
And Jeff, you say this is not a big deal for kids coming up through elementary and high school education. They're doing more and more online. This is going to be very natural, even expected by them.
No, and it was very similar to what John was talking about at Stanford, this idea of flipping the classroom, right? And students right now and in middle school and high school are very used to this, right? So they go on to the Khan Academy at night. They don't understand a math concept. You know, they can practice.
Khan Academy, this is Salman Khan's with 3,000 different mini lessons. You can go and take any
of them. So you don't understand a math concept. You can sit there for hours at night and practice over and over again. You can't do that in a physical classroom. So this idea that students are doing the work that they might have done in a classroom now at home or online or in a coffee shop, and kind of this high-touch, high-impact stuff where professors really matter, where the physical environment really matters is happening there. And that really was what I think is the power of the hybrid course, and it's how students are learning. And I think that's the biggest issue here. It's in some ways, it doesn't really matter what higher ed wants to do. It really, in the market, I think, is going to force this in the coming years because the students coming up through the pipeline in middle school and high school and elementary school definitely are learning in this way.
Hey, but Jeff,
they're going to force the change.
We've got listeners calling in and saying, you know, great, but I did some of this online. Then when I went out to the job market, I couldn't get respect for my online education, the kind that you would expect from bricks and mortar. What about that? How does it translate into that? Does the credential really sell in the job market?
Oh, well, the credential still matters. And so that's why, for example, these MOOCs, I mean, you can take 12 MOOCs and not be able to get a job from it because you're not going to have a credential at the end of the day. You're going to have a degree.
Yeah.
And the other issue, though, is that, you know, I think probably many of your callers went to what are thought of as online-only universities, or they went to for-profit universities, which are often thought of as only online. And that's probably why they didn't get the respect. I mean, you know, now you have a number of other universities, many universities, University of up in your area there, Southern New Hampshire University is one of the largest online providers in the country now. And that's a traditional university. And most people, when you're looking at a resume, you don't know if the person got the degree online or didn't.
Let's go to Kathy in Providence, Rhode Island. Kathy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm just concerned that the discussion about why one of the main reasons why costs have gone so sky high are the business models and the lack of state and federal funding for higher education. So we used to be able to educate whole, you know, middle class at colleges like City College of New York for free. And I understand that, you know, times have changed, but this is a real value and need in the society. And I don't think a business model for educating people, you know, we see what's happening now. It's been this way with the newspapers. Oh, it's going to be great. Everything's going to be online. And then, you know, 5 to 10 years down the road, it changes. And it is a for-profit thing.
Well, there's a lot of for-profit already, but you're right. If you take government funding out, and there has been so much in American education for so long, you've got a really different profile, raises big issues about people who don't have a lot of means in their family. On the other hand, the internet ought to be able to get it out to people. I mean, hypothetically, there ought to be something here for folks who don't necessarily, maybe can't afford that lush, gorgeous campus, but could get the education really focused and targeted. Let us pick that up, Kathy. Mark Taylor joins us right now. He's chair of the religion department at Columbia University. He made a stir back in 2009. He published an opinion piece in the New York Times entitled End the University as We Know It. Came out with a book, Crisis on Campus, A Bold Plan for Reforming Our Colleges and Universities. He sees big time change coming. Mark Taylor, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Delighted to be here.
So, you know, you hear Kathy there saying, look, the funding doesn't seem to be there, and people who need education aren't getting it. The business model in internet era may or may not be good for spreading this around to be sure that we have a widely well-educated population. Do you see an internet revolution coming, Mark, and is it better or worse?
Yes, I'm delighted. I'm delighted that you and your colleagues are addressing this issue, because it has become urgent within the past several years. Yes, there's an internet revolution going on. One of the interesting questions is why it has taken off so rapidly within the last 10 months to 1 year. These technologies have been around. In fact, in 1999, Herbert Allen in New York City and I started a company, Global Education Network, to provide high-quality online education in the liberal arts, humanities, and sciences to all people of all ages across the
world. We are not a perfectly efficient species, are we? There's a lag sometimes, but here it comes.
Right. I think the reason is, as you suggested, there is a certain kind of bubble at work here. And that bubble takes effect both for the colleges and universities on the one hand and for the students on the other. Student debt we've talked about. Mm. Many of these colleges are under enormous financial strain, so that financial exigency is forcing change that rational argumentation could not. So yes, it's coming. There are going to be pluses and minuses in this. I firmly believe, as Jeff and others have said, that there can be enormously positive things to come out of this. But we must also understand the complexities of these changes and the way they will impact other aspects of the higher education system.
Well, speak to us about that. John Mitchell says this is not instead of the traditional college. This will supplement or, you know, sort of hybridized. Do you agree?
Yes, I think in some cases that I think that will be the case. But I also think, as I forget who it was was mentioning, these large conglomerates that are now taking, say, MIT and Stanford, Princeton, Yale, and others, do pose both an opportunity and a threat to these, to many of the smaller schools and community colleges. On the one hand, it will allow students to take courses they might not otherwise be able to take. But on the other hand, as you've suggested, for some the question will come, why pay $50,000 for a third-rate school when I can get certificates of completion from MIT or Yale? I think it's also the case that we need to be sensitive to the different kinds of education that take place in the online environment. I've taught in both contexts. I don't think everything can be taught effectively online. Students read differently. They think differently. They cultivate different skills. And indeed, there is now, we've been at this long enough now that there's sufficient neuroscience research to document this.
But let me ask you on the cost front. If the cost of what we have now is unsustainable, and for many people it certainly feels like it is, all that debt, $1 trillion plus of student debt now, does it mean that if we're going to go to something less expensive and more online, does some part of that traditional infrastructure and college system, maybe a very substantial part, go away, Mark Taylor, or not?
Yes, I think it will.
What? Like what? What? What portion?
Well,
what?
I think a lot of these smaller schools are going to going to collapse. Many of them are in serious financial trouble. We also must understand that what we regard as a traditional college student, the term's been used in the program, 18 to 22-year-olds, constitutes only about 18% of the total student post-secondary population. That is to say, roughly 85% is non-traditional. And for those people, many of them are working in an increasing number, they can't be in the same place at the same time every day. So there are opportunities here, but there will be fallout. I think it's also important. You pressed the new dean from Stanford on the business model. I've asked myself what are these major schools up to. I do not believe they're acting out of the altruistic motives in all this. I believe there is implicitly or explicitly a clear business decision being made. There are only three ways colleges can expand: spatially, build more dorms; temporally, increase the number of students; or virtually, increase your student population by having virtual classes to generate income. And many schools are using this way as a way to increase income by increasing student enrollment without having them physically present. And I think part of what's going to happen is the big will get bigger and will pose threats to many of these small schools.
Let me ask Provost Mitchell while we have him. John Mitchell, are you, however idealistic you may be right now, is there a kind of inevitability to a push for global domination here by elite schools like yours?
I think global domination would be overstating it. We do have a lot of enthusiasm from faculty, and that's really what's driving it is reaching more students. But if we reach more students, I suppose you can do the arithmetic. That means some students are not going to other places. That's possible. But it's also possible that more people will get involved and more people will spend more time learning, and there's great demand for a greater educated workforce. So that's the other way this could all work out, is we could all expand, that everyone would be better off in that case, too.
Do you not have somewhere in your strategic command there at Stanford a revenue model out of this? When would that kick in?
Well, I think that really comes second for us. We really like to understand how to reach people, how to teach better online. There's some really great questions. You know, how do we teach history online? That's not really a multiple choice sort of topic. How do we help people interact, ask questions? A lot of education is about learning to think critically and interact with others and have your ideas tested. So that's really where our focus is. And I think there are many ways that we could try to expand our own programs, charge in different ways for different kinds of things. But that's really going to come over a course of years. We're really just trying to follow the enthusiasm and respond to the interest people have at learning.
John Mitchell, Stanford University's first ever Vice Provost for Online Learning. They're mounting a big effort there. John, thanks so much for joining us from Stanford today. Great to have you with us.
Great. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about our high-cost, maybe unsustainable college system, higher education, at the breaking point in some ways, and now facing an internet revolution. It's been around. Now it's kicking in. Mark Taylor's here from Columbia, author of Crisis on Campus. Jeff Salingo with the Chronicle of Higher Education. His forthcoming book is College Unbound. We've got all kinds of responses here. You know, AD says, I'm currently finishing a master's degree in finance law online, accredited law school, really working for me. I really think the efficacy of online programs depends on the field of study. He says, I don't think a degree in science will be possible here. We'll talk about that. He says, my classes are all web conferences where everyone participates via web camera and microphone, but they are not in the same place. Yar says, how much education is in class and how much is learning to live with people who see the world differently from you? We could do much of what colleges do with 2 years of public service and then maybe the rest online, something like that. Here's another, says, so much of the rising cost of education, I believe, are to fund things that are attractive to parents sending their kids to college, but do little to improve the value of education. New shiny dormitories, top-notch fitness facilities. Hey, I don't know. If that does that stick around? If we go online, Matt in Springfield, Illinois. Thanks for calling, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My name is Matt. I'm in an MBA program, and it's an accelerated program where we don't meet every day.
Okay.
And we meet, sort of on the weekends, and internet stuff is integrated into that program.
Okay.
And I've just seen a trend moving towards accelerated programs. It's still a brick and mortar thing, but we still have internet, and I see the trend going towards accelerated programs, internet, and I think the market's just going to dictate that. Younger workforce gets into management roles and stuff like that, 10 years down the road, I think.
Do you think employers, Matt, will give the same weight down the road, as you say, to an online degree as they give today to a brick-and-mortar degree?
I think so. As the younger demographic moves into those management roles, I think it will.
They look at it and say, why not? Matt, I appreciate your call. One more here. Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Brooke is calling. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Okay.
I think my big concern with this whole thing, I just completed my master's degree as well, a very traditional program, brick and mortar, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
And I've taken online courses, and I've actually assisted in instructing online courses. And I think that the big issue that these online programs are facing is that they're not receiving the respect of a traditional degree because they really just, I don't feel like can offer what a traditional degree offers. I don't think that you get nearly as much out of a class that you take entirely online as you can get out of meeting with your teacher and your students and the traditional classroom instruction, and then certainly an entire degree I think that's gotten online. When you're talking about 18-year-olds, 20-year-olds, coming out of high school, they get so much more out of a 4-year degree than just being qualified to do a job.
Brooke, may I ask you, I understand what you're saying. On the other hand, we know we've got a problem. I mean, page one stories about debt collectors doing huge. Did you come out with the debt yourself, Brooke?
I'm $50,000 in debt right
okay.
now, and I totally understand that something needs to be done. But I'm just afraid that if we look at online education as the answer and really the only avenue to fix this problem,
right.
We're going to be losing a lot of what we are intended to get out of a college education.
Brooke, I appreciate your call as well. Mark Taylor, come in here. There's our first caller says, a new generation is going to come up, and they're going to respect online education, and they're going to hire people with that kind of certification. And then there's Brooke, who says, and many others, there is something to that physical experience that can't be recreated online, and she worries about what that quality will be. I mean, how do you think things will break down as the internet really starts to come into this arena more strongly, Mark?
Well, I think in fact both callers are right, each in his her own way.
Mm-hmm.
We do have to understand the extent, as the first caller indicated, the extent to which younger people coming up, even children down in the before kindergarten, are becoming increasingly adept with these technologies. And indeed, a recent study suggests that by 2018, I think about 50% of the courses that high school students take will be online. So they're going to be acclimated to this kind of environment, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there are obvious, to me at least, having taught for many years at a small liberal arts college and now at Columbia, there are obvious advantages to the face-to-face and the like. The problem, as we've indicated, is that financially it is simply unsustainable to have as much of the face-to-face because of the expense.
Yep.
I there are courses that I teach that I do not think I could teach online, and seminars and major philosophical figures are difficult to teach online.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there have to be ways in which some of this kind of education can be used to supplement. I should also say that I think that part of what is going on nationwide as a whole, and I think some of the online issues exacerbated, is that the arts and humanities are in a crisis state, are in peril in ways I have never seen them in 40 years.
What do you mean?
There is simply not the support for them at many institutions.
Because of the state funding cutbacks, or why?
Well, that's part of it. That's part of it. I mean, if you look historically, there have been basically three patronage systems in history, church, state, and private, and they've all broken down at one level or another. But the problem is that arts and humanities courses don't generate revenue other than in terms of the students in the classroom, whereas many institutions, Columbia included, are doubling down on various aspects of the sciences and engineering and the like in the hope of being able to cash in on patents and licensing.
Right.
So there, you know, there's and some of the science courses and technology can be taught more effectively online than some of the humanities.
But let me ask you, if I may, I mean, where does this really go? We have a financial crisis here, cutbacks in state and church and private maybe too, as you say. But for families, we're reading day after day, and for graduates, it's just too much. I mean, what does this online revolution mean if it doesn't take the cost of that American year of college and cut it by half or cut it by two-thirds? Doesn't that have to be part of what we're looking for here so we have access?
Yes, that has to be part of it. The other issue that I think will happen, and this goes back to a term that Jeff used, the notion of unbundling. That's a very important term, and it's been used in business as well. I think that courses will become unbundled. I think the whole college experience will become unbundled in the sense that we have basically now a model of higher education that's based on the notion of mass production.
Mm-hmm.
I would talk about unbundling in terms of a mass customization. When I've asked people the question that I've yet to receive an answer, why is college 4 years? Why is each course more or less the same length?
Mm-hmm.
Why does it take a set number of credits?
It's like a Ford production line.
Precisely. So if you move from mass production, and that's the model that was used, it goes back 200 years, mm-hmm. to mass customization, you build in a much greater flexibility. And if you move from a quantitative to a qualitative mode of assessment, that is to say, assess a person not on the number of courses taken, but on his or her knowledge, the model changes completely. So it might not require 4 years of education, or it might not require X number of courses to gain a certain number of competence.
And it may not require that all these come from one institution. I mean, Jeff...
Absolutely. So, that's exactly what's going to happen.
Jeff, how would this unbundled a la carte business work? I mean, if I'm at, I don't know, fill-in-the-blank college in the middle of the country, and, you know, I'm doing some stuff there, but now I'm taking massive open online courses from Stanford or Harvard at the same time, and maybe from University of Southern New Hampshire, or you name it. And maybe some are a semester long and some are dependent just on my performance, what I can prove that I know. How does that all get bundled into the accreditation? I mean, the education is a piece of it, and there's also the certification.
Right. I mean, and the big hurdle right now is credit transfer, right? So at some point, somebody has to recognize all this learning and give you a credential. And the problem right now in much of higher ed is that many institutions don't want to recognize that because they want those – first of all, some of the faculty say, well, these are not quality courses if you took them somewhere else. And on the other side is the business side of it. You want more students
to take more
courses.
They want 8 full semesters of tuition.
Right. They want the tuition, right? So you have both sides. I mean, I think, Tom, part of the difficulty in this conversation is that we tend to treat higher education as a system, as this monolithic system in the U.S., and we don't have one, right? So we have, you know, 18 to 24-year-olds. We have returning adults. We have people going for their master's degrees. I mean, there's not one size fits all and one answer to all of this.
Well, true, but there is a kind of river that flows through our conventional understanding of what college education is. And it's 4 years, and it tends
and
to be at
4 years,
one place.
But we also tend to romanticize, by the way, the classroom, right? You know, one of your callers talked about high quality in the classroom and lower quality online. Well, you know, not all classrooms are created equal, and not all online providers are created equal. And so, I mean, so some online providers are better than others, and some classrooms are better than others. I mean, there is a piece of the higher education's experience, for especially for the 18-year-old, is that maturing experience, right? I don't think personally that most 18-year-olds are ready to go right into the workforce. They need some skills that they don't have, but more importantly, they need that maturing aspect. Now, one of your callers brought up the idea of national service, and in researching my book, I've run into a lot of students who have taken so-called gap years to volunteer and to work for places like AmeriCorps, which could be potentially that maturing experience. science. And then perhaps you don't need 4 years of college. You might only need a couple of years of college, especially if you could get through more quickly using online courses.
Let's go to Zoe in Nashville, Tennessee. Zoe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was in college and I had to drop out, and I was an English major. And right now I can't afford to go back, so I was thrilled to hear about these online courses.
Yeah.
But I noticed there weren't a lot of humanities ones available for a long time. There are mostly statistics and computer science. But I finally found a website that offers a small handful of humanities. And I was kind of wondering why this is, or if I'll see more of this in the future. Is humanities not as highly valued, or does it just not translate well to online courses?
That's a great question, and I hope you find your way fully back onto that ladder, Zoe. Mark Taylor, what about it? Is this a science-oriented medium, the Internet, for education?
Yeah. It's an excellent question, and I alluded to it before. I think in my experience, and I've taught different ways. In my experience, there are courses that are less effectively done online, and some of those tend to be humanities. I also think that there are different ways to do online education. Some of it is the these massive online courses that we're talking about, but you can also use effectively, and I've done this, telepresence. That is to say, to just expand the bounds of the classroom.
Video conferencing, Skyping in,
Skype, and all that kind of stuff. That you can do that you can simulate something like a discussion in that way, and that can work effectively. That can be an effective means of cost control for colleges and universities because they can share faculty and they can expand that way. And I have taught courses on figures as difficult as Hegel and Melville using that kind of medium, and it can be done. It doesn't scale in the same way as a course in which you can have lectures and quiz sets but it can be done, I think, and it must be done.
If this is the way we're going, Mark is calling. Hi, Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Doesn't online learning further promote the fracturing of our society? I've been talking to people for years about homeschooling and how homeschoolers aren't really getting the socialization they need across the board. And part of college is that shared experience of being with other people and learning about other people and having the kind of personal education that you don't get online.
Absolutely. Mark, I appreciate your call as well. John, what do you say? I mean, there's socialization right across the country. There's also, I can't help wondering here as we talk about this, several people have said, well, Harvard's not going away. Stanford's not going away. Is it going to be where if you don't have a pot of cash, you're going to go online? And if you do, you're going to go to an elite school and we'll be back where we were 100 years ago, where we had, the elites in a few Ivy League colleges and everybody else grubbing it out online. Mark?
So 2 points. First, to the caller's point, it's an excellent question, and in fact, I think it points to a broader issue with the Internet and the web. And that is, and it's a paradox, and I've only come to appreciate its significance recently.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, you think of the web as breaking down silos, but in many ways, the more connected we become, the more divided we become, because mass customization that we just talked about
within our specialties,
exactly, especially within specialties. The other point is a broader one that you just raised, Tom, and that is we talk about the wealth gap in this country in many, many ways. One of the biggest and most significant wealth gaps is within higher education, between the wealth, very, very wealthy, and the not so wealthy institutions, and that existed obviously before the Internet revolution, but there is the potential with the kind of moves that MIT and Harvard and these places are, that the rich are going to get richer and the poor are going to disappear, that the wealth gap will increase. And
our state universities, which we've invested so much in and so much pride in and have given such great educations to so many people, Mark?
As we speak, the greatest state system in the country, if not in the world, California, is dissolving. Is it going to go away?
Jeez.
No. But it is a wreck, and it's a tragedy. That's what I said. The state funding has declined. Private funding cannot keep up with this. So there's an enormous financial problem for many institutions, on the college, on the side of the colleges and universities.
Jeff, will you have massive access, but more stratification somehow? That would seem to be an ironic outcome of this.
Well, and it's something I do worry about, but to be honest with you, we've already have this mass stratification, especially among students. You know, in the last decade, the percentage of students getting a bachelor's degree from families at the highest income levels has now grown to 82%. At the bottom, it's fallen to 8%. 8%, 82%. So we already have had this over the last decade.
But that's not sustainable for us as a country, is it? Everybody says we've got to have a much better educated. Well, so who's steering this ship?
But see, that's the power of the online and hybrid, especially if they could be high quality. You know, what I think, what I fear, and what I worry about is that if we force the people without college degrees and the people who can't afford to go or can't get into places like Harvard to go to low quality alternatives, then we're really in trouble.
Mark Taylor, can we make it high quality? Can this be the technology that makes it available to all for real, you know, upward mobility and national success?
Yes, but it's not going to be easy and it's not going to be cheap.
And it may not be without some very careful attention, it sounds like to me. Mark Taylor, author of Crisis on Campus at Columbia University, joining us today from New York. Professor Taylor, thank you very much for your time and insights today.
Thank you.
Jeff Salingo, editor-at-large for the Chronicle of Higher Education, author of Look For It, College Unbound. Jeff, thanks for your time.
It's great to be here.
And listeners, thanks for your time and insights. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.